Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. This is Bonnie Kay, and welcome to the Straight Wives Talk Show. This is a hard-hitting show that discusses the complexity of marriages between straight women to gay men. Each week, my guests and I discuss issues that affect over 4 million women in this country and millions more around the world who find themselves unknowingly married to a gay or bisexual man. If you have any comments you'd like to make during this broadcast, you can write to me at bonkay@AOL.com, that's B-O-N-K-A-Y-E, @AOL.com. And if you have any questions for my guest, you can forward them to me, and I'll make sure that she gets them and get back to you. Before I introduce my very special guest for tonight, I would like to just mention that our healing weekend is coming up in April, the weekend of the 13th and the 14th. It's going to be in Irvine, California. It's going to be an amazing weekend with women coming in from not only all over the country, but several from other countries as well. California, like I say, is a very important place to be right now. We have many women who are in that location who are not able to get out to the East Coast when we have them here. So if you'd like to have a beautiful weekend, meet some wonderful people, have some excellent bonding, wonderful speakers and workshops, that's the weekend and where to be. And I know that it's a sacrifice. That's why there's no cost for the weekend other than $75 that goes for the food that you have, lunch and a beautiful buffet dinner. And we have a group rate for the hotel. So if you want any information at all, write to me at bonkay@AOL.com. Without further ado, I'm going to be introducing my very special guest, who's been kind enough to join us several times throughout the year, Dr. Margalis Felstad. Dr. Felstad, thank you so much for joining the show again, because you were such a popular guest here because of the books that you've written.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, your books really seem to be life changers for so many women. That's how I originally met you back in 2014. One of my, you know, support group members had said to me, you know what, I've been suffering, you know how much, the last couple of years. And she said, my life changed when I read this book. And I said, well, what book could possibly change your life that much? And she said to me, I read a book called Stop Caretaking the Borderline or Narcissist and How to Get Out of the Drama and Get On with Your Life. And she says, this book, she said, no matter how, she said, now, there are dozens of books on this since, you know, my marriage broke up. But this was a defining book that changed my life. And I said, wow, that's quite a statement. I have to get this book myself. And then when I did, and I read it, and I could understand why it changed her life. And I thought, well, I'm just going to be a pest and track down this wonderful woman who wrote this wonderful book. And that's how we first met back in 2014. And you've been so supportive of our women ever since then. You have wonderful newsletters and on your website, all different kinds of articles. And I know so many of our women tell me after they read your book, it's just such an eye-opener to them. So let's talk a little bit tonight about the books that you do have before we get on with our questions. That was your first book. And since that time, you have your second book, Healing from a Narcissistic Relationship, Understanding, Coping, Recovery, Empowerment, and Transformation. And this is like the next step after you already get out of the drama. This is how to heal. Am I correct?
That's correct, yes. And it has lots of exercises and suggestions and thought-provoking questions to really help each reader really get in touch with the kind of healing that they need to do.
And there's some really excellent tips in there, as you were mentioning. But, you know, first of all, even after you get out of the relationships, I think that there's a lot of baggage that's left over that's part of that healing process. I think a lot of times women doubt themselves and they blame themselves. Do you find that's a common thing that happens to women after these marriages?
Absolutely, yes. In fact, I'm doing a lot of writing right now about self-compassion because I see women who have been in marriages where they've been taken advantage of and their partner has really thought only about themselves and how damaging that is. And the tendency is for women to blame themselves. What could I have done? I should have seen this. But in fact, healing happens when you really accept yourself as a human being and are kind and loving to yourself. So I think that's a very important part of healing.
I agree with you. One of the things that you mentioned in this book, and once again, this book is just amazing. This was, I bought it as soon as it came out because I felt if it was any tribute like the last book to helping people, it'd be just what people needed, the next step. But one of the things I think that women don't realize who are involved with narcissists, and many of our women are, is that when they end the relationship, it's for numerous reasons, as you write. One's for boredom, not getting their insatiable needs met, or something else that pulls their attention away. They want to be romance again. They think you're causing discontent. They don't like being responsible to you or for you. They want a new adventure. You know, sometimes there's nothing more to it than that. You know, women are always questioning themselves, why is this happening? What did I do wrong? And sometimes it has nothing to do with them. Would you say that's pretty true?
Certainly with a narcissist, the woman had nothing to do with it. Narcissists make their choices based pretty much entirely on their own needs and wants. And, you could be the most beautiful and delightful person in the world, and the narcissist just wants more attention or they want something new and interesting, and off they go.
I think one of the problems that we have, especially with the women that I work with in our group, is that we don't try to totally understand the whole conception of, or the whole concept of a narcissist. Because, as you know, because you explain it so well in all of your writing, a narcissist in the beginning is very charming to you. They come on to you and make you feel like you're the only person in the world that matters. And, you know, once they get you trapped, I understand things change. But is any of it true, do you think? I mean, can they
have
feelings?
Well, actually, they do have feelings. And one of the big differences, for instance, between a narcissist and a sociopath is a narcissist really does want a relationship. It's just that they are totally incapable of really fulfilling their part of the relationship. But they want you to stay anyway and do things that will make them feel good. And they really love that, and they can oftentimes appreciate it. They want to have families. They want to be connected, but they honestly don't have the capacity to truly be an intimate partner.
I think that's a really important concept.
Yeah, I think of their problems as an emotional disability. That is, they would like to, and they talk up a good storyline about how wonderful your relationship's going to be and your life's going to be and everything's fabulous, but they can't follow through. They can't do their part. And yet, at the same time, they demand that you fulfill those fantasies.
How do you think this happens? You know, we always have this discussion with, you know, other therapists and psychologists. Is this nature over nurture, combination of both? But is it something that can ever change?
Well, I'm quite convinced after working with this for over 30 years is that it's some of both. We know that narcissism runs in families, and we know that part of that is genetically inherited to the way the brain is functioning. And we also know that part of it is learned. You learn it from the people around you. The trouble with narcissism is that people who have this disorder really like being narcissistic because they get everything they want and they don't have to be responsible. They blame everyone else if things go wrong. So the world is designed, their world is designed to make them feel great. So they're not motivated at all to do any kind of work to try and change that.
Are there people who have narcissistic behavior as opposed to being a full-blown narcissist?
Oh, absolutely. Every human being on the earth has narcissistic behaviors. Narcissism is at the core of survival instinct. So we need some narcissism to function as a human being. We need some narcissism to have good self-esteem. But what's happened with people with the disorder is that it's so extreme that they really don't have empathy for other people. So that piece is missing. And that results in them just focusing on their needs. And they honestly seem sometimes very confused that other people have different needs or thoughts or feelings.
Do you think they ever realize that they're like this?
Some do. It appears to me to be a very small number, but some people do. I just got a letter from a gentleman who was engaged, and his girlfriend said, "No, I can't marry you. I've realized I'm a narcissist, and I need to work on that because I'm going to ruin your life." I was quite impressed that someone would have that awareness. She was young, and so she wasn't really stuck in the patterns, perhaps, as much as people are as they go through life. But some people do. I would say the vast majority are not aware, or they push that awareness away by blaming everyone else.
Are there any common characteristics that women can watch out for, let's say, before you get too involved with someone?
Well, I've always had a rule when I meet somebody is that listen to who they are and what they have to say, and then start talking about myself for a while and wait to see if they ask me any questions about myself. to see if they show any real direct interest or they just turn the conversation back on themselves. The other thing I suggest to people is ask the person to do something you know they don't want to do, like go to a schmaltzy movie or something that you know the guy probably wouldn't want to go to. And is he willing to go to it because you want to go? So you can test it out a little bit. Mm-hmm. The trouble for a lot of people when they meet a narcissist is that they fall for the fantasy too easily. They think this person is going to provide for them all the things they've dreamed of, and it's just going to be handed to them. And they haven't really thought through how that's going to happen.
I'm just always, you know, I look back and I see the women who are part of our network who have, so many of them have husbands that are, they've identified as having narcissistic behavior and who are narcissists or a combination of narcissistic and sociopaths. But the thing is that I think that we all have some kind of common bond of being caretakers to some degree. Would you say that in general, in your opinion, do you think that women are kind of socialized from the time we're young to be caretakers?
Well, women are socialized, and so are men, to be caretakers, but in different ways. Women who get involved with narcissists or borderline people are often very super empathetic. In fact, they feel the other person's feelings rather than sticking to their own feelings. They put everyone else's needs above their own. They often aren't taking real good care of themselves, or they're willing to give it up too easily. They have a tendency to enjoy other people being happy, and there's nothing wrong with that. But it can leave you vulnerable to a narcissist who, at the beginning, is happy about everything you do in order to encourage you to do it more. So we can be sucked in. But I think the qualities that people who are caretakers have are wonderful humanitarian characteristics. We see people in arenas, people who are nurturing and empathetic, who are nurses and therapists and caretakers of all kinds, in which as a profession, of course, we get paid and we get reciprocal rewards. But when you're in a relationship in which you're doing all of the caretaking, the other person isn't doing anything, then you're going to be deeply, deeply taken advantage of.
Now, I'm reading something that you had written a few years ago that really struck me pretty hard. I wonder why. But I just would like to read it back to you. And it says, caretaking behaviors aren't just triggered by narcissists and borderlines. You can fall into caretaking anyone you care about just because they are struggling, sad, hurting, or in some way needy. Oftentimes, caretakers step in and take responsibility before giving the other person time to struggle with their issues or feelings and come up with a solution on their own. In that case, you're actually keeping the other person from growing and maturing by your caretaking. And if the other person doesn't want your help, advice, or benefit, they can actually get angry at your interference. Wait until somebody actually asks you for help and has his or her own plan on how you can help. And then ask yourself, is this really something that you want to do before jumping in, giving in, or taking responsibility to fix? And I think some of us really tend to do that. You know, we see somebody struggling, we want to make it better. We know that we could do it if we, you know, make their life better. I mean, I think it's done for sincere reasons, but a lot of times people don't want you doing it. Is that true in your experience?
Right. They don't want you to do it, or they may want you to do it, but you're actually keeping them from learning the lesson they need to learn. You are making it easy for them. And that certainly happens as a parent. We can step in too soon because we see our child in distress and try and fix it for them rather than teaching them how to cope and how to be resilient.
Mm-hmm. I think that's very true, and it interplays not only into your life and your relationship, but also with your children, because I really do believe children model themselves after their parents. And do you find that to be so?
Oh, absolutely. And if you're a super-duper caretaker for an adult who can take care of themselves, your children see that, and they want to become a prince or princess too, so they expect you to do it for them as well. And then you have children that become adults that really can't cope. But the other thing is, if you are overly solicitous to other people, they can get angry at you for interfering with them, giving them too much advice. Typically, people don't want real advice. They want you to support what they've decided to do. But they don't want you to come in and take over.
Exactly, because it gives them a feeling of helplessness and feeling inadequate that you're judging them for what they decided to do.
Right, right. So they don't feel supported in that. They feel kind of you've come in to be the dictator or the savior, and that often breaks up friendships and relationships.
One of the things that you wrote several years ago that also really impressed me was about red flags for identifying when you're entering the caretaking zone, as you call it, caretaking zone. And they included that you ignore your own interests and activities by changing your habits and activities to match the other person, canceling activities with friends to please the other person, putting off goals you have in order to pay for the things someone else wants, not returning phone calls to friends, and having difficulty remembering what you like to do. Then you talk about trying harder, continually deferring to the other person's needs and wants, always trying to be available, giving up your own preferences and passions to please the other person, not expressing your thoughts, feelings, and ideas as to not rock the boat, trying harder when you are being treated the worst, putting yourself into debt to meet the needs of someone else, condoning behavior from the other that is against your values. And then also you write about discounting your needs and wants, giving up good relationships with friends and family to keep this relationship, typically arranging to do what you want when the other person is not around, feeling selfish or asking others to accommodate your needs and wants, pretending that you don't need anything, ignoring your own health needs, finding yourself continually saying whatever you want, giving in to keep the peace. And then you have lowering self-esteem, feeling confused about why you do what you do, acting contrary to your own values, increased criticism and frustration at not being good enough, losing your spiritual center, feeling unappreciated, high levels of stress, exhaustion, and overwhelm, putting up with hurtful and mean comments to you from others, feeling hopeless and helpless. And this really hit me hard when I read it, because I remember the days when I was married to my ex-husband, and I went through all of this. You know, I was really like the prime example of all of these horrible emotions that I was going through, where people told me that they didn't even recognize me anymore. They said, "You lost yourself. You know, where are you?" Like, they're knocking on my head, "Come out, come back." You know, I was like a dish rag, and it didn't take long to make me like that, only a few years. But when you live with somebody who's
that's a good clue to you that you're falling into that when your friends or family say, "Oh, you're acting so different. You seem so different than how I know you to be." That's a clue that maybe you need to look at that list of things and see which ones you're doing. And naturally, when we get into a relationship, we're going to make some accommodations. We're going to make some changes. But when you find your own goals and values and feelings and the things that are important to you kind of being brushed aside or put on hold so you can take care of this other person's needs, those are big red flags to you that you're giving up your life for someone else because they're too lazy to do it for themselves. And I think that's a huge destructive thing that that we do to ourselves, and we don't need to. If you can't feel comfortable being who you are with the person that you love, as comfortable as you are with your friends, then what's going on there? Why are you having to be somebody else or act differently because you're with this certain person and you want to please them? What about, you know, taking care of yourself and then seeing who pleases you?
Yeah, I think that's good advice when you're strong. But I think I was strong when I started out in that relationship. I was a very strong woman. And that's how I try to have a lot of understanding towards the women I work with, because I think I started in a really strong place, and it didn't take much. You know, he was very volatile and always screaming and yelling. And, you know, I'm not a person by nature who likes conflict. You know, I like to live in peace. And, in fact, one of our, you know, members of our support group who, you know, was a guest many times on our show, she's a health nutritionist, you know, coach. You know, she came from a very abusive marriage, and she has tattooed on her two hands, "Love is kind," as a constant reminder of that's what love is supposed to be. But,
wow,
you know, she was living
wonderful.
Through this, and I was, I think it's wonderful that people see that that's the way love should be.
Yeah.
It shouldn't have to be. But people say, well, we'd like to fight and make up. No, you shouldn't have to like to fight and make up. You shouldn't have to get, I mean, marriage shouldn't be one big fight and making up. I mean, maybe it's exciting for, you know, a little bit, but. You know, I think that one of the
I hear from a lot of women that statement that you made earlier, I really like to live in peace. The thing I question is, then why aren't you? If you have a partner that is yelling at you and blaming you and not considering your point of view or your feelings, hanging in there and giving into them is just going to reinforce it. It's not going to make the other person nicer. And I think as women, we're often taught, well, if you're nice, then other people will be nice to you. But that isn't really the case in a lot of times. You have to stand up for yourself, and you have to decide for yourself, is this the life I want? Not, is this a life I hope it'll change into? It either is or it isn't. And facing the fact of looking at, is this a life I want now? Then that gives you the answer. But, of course, when we're in love and we're engrossed in the narcissist's fantasy of what's going to happen anytime soon, then we get really caught up.
And I think that really is the problem. You know, if we weren't in love with someone, would we accept this kind of treatment, let's say, from a coworker, even from a friend? I mean, would we, if people were treating us this way and saying nasty things to us and yelling at us and making us feel bad about themselves, how long would we stay in that kind of a relationship? Right?
That's a great question. I think that's exactly what we need to ask ourselves. Exactly.
And you know, that's why.
And what would my best friend suggest I do if they knew what was really going on?
Mm-hmm.
It helps give
true,
some perspective.
Yeah, I think that if we step outside our love relationship and say, why do I let somebody treat me this way? Then it's, you know, much easier to you know, maybe see it for what it is, but I think love is the real problem because when we love someone, and plus the fact when they started out, they were so nice to us that we keep thinking, where did this go wrong? And especially when they tell us that we're the ones who went wrong, and we start questioning ourselves.
Well,
because
yes, that's exactly the case. We're being told in these relationships that you're the problem. And when you're an empathetic person, you're going to give the other person the benefit of the doubt. So you're going to look at that and say, well, maybe I am. Maybe it's my fault. I'll just try harder. But the trouble is with narcissists, the more you try, the worse it gets, not the better. And that's another kind of marker or clue to watch. As you give in and as you try harder to be nice, it doesn't make a difference. If it doesn't make a difference within a few weeks or a month, it's not going to change. So you need to be looking at those clues.
Yeah, and I think that's maybe explain that a little bit. This is not a back and forth and better times and worse times. This is going to be a permanent thing. When somebody has a personality disorder, this is not like taking a pill for an antidepressant, or it's not like fixing some kind of physical condition. This is the personality disorder that doesn't get ordered, so to say. I mean, it's going to stay a disorder. Would that be correct?
That's right. I mean, would you be able to suddenly change your personality to something else? Well, the narcissist can't either. So this is, a lot of times we talk ourselves into, well, the next time he does such and such, then I will know. But then it happens, and then we go through the whole routine of, oh, that's not what I meant, you misinterpreted, and they really create a fantasy or a delusion that you fall into because you want to. You really want to be able to stay with this person that you love. So it's a long process, and many people say, well, I was in this relationship for years. Well, that's true for most people. Narcissists are very good at convincing you to stay and always promising that things will get better. It's very hard to leave. It's very hard to see reality. And that's why I tell people in these relationships, you need to have friends. You need to have support people. You need to have therapists or financial advisors or lawyers out there who can look at your situation and tell you the truth and not just rely on this one person.
I read something someone wrote on a blog yesterday, and I just wanted to share it with you to get your opinion. I thought it was very interesting. It says, I don't believe that a narc NPD targets a specific type of person. I believe that a person with a healthy love for themselves can see through this. They aren't interested in them, and thus they don't get into a relationship with them. When you have a healthy love for yourself, you like who you are. You know your self-worth, you respect yourself, and you don't allow anyone to disrespect you. You make decisions based on logic and not completely on emotions. You are able to put yourself first without feeling guilty. When you love yourself, you treat yourself as though you would treat your child. You want to protect your child. You want your child to be safe, and you only want to see good things for them. You can see things in their friends that they can't see. You sense trouble and try to teach them how to avoid it. You trust yourself in the decisions you make for your child. You love them. When you lack a healthy love for yourself, you don't protect yourself from things you know aren't healthy. You want to feel good about yourself, but the only way you know how to feel good is with emotions and not logic. One more drink and I'll feel better. That new dress will make me feel pretty. If I had more money, everything would be good. If only he loved me. We look for external things to make us happy instead of looking within ourselves. As a child, we learn from our parents our view of life and how we view ourselves. As parents, we love our children, but we don't realize that we aren't sending the right message. I'm not blaming parents. I'm a parent and I love my son deeply. I would never want to cause him pain. I want him to be confident, make healthy choices for himself, and to be happy with who he is. Only problem is, how do I know how to teach him that, especially when I've never been taught? I grew up with little self-esteem. I could never do anything that pleased my parents. My sister was the perfect child. She never got in trouble. My sister never had friends. She stayed in her room and watched TV. She was mommy's little girl. She enjoyed getting me in trouble. It took attention off her and gave her a sense of control. Our father was an alcoholic with NPD. We were taught to walk on eggshells. Our opinions didn't count, and we were never heard. We were taught to survive. Our emotional needs were of no importance. I never felt unloved, but I never felt safe. The things I was taught as a child made me the perfect person for someone who needed someone to abuse. I lacked everything needed to stand up for myself. I wasn't taught to protect myself, only to avoid situations. I wouldn't think of voicing my opinion. Why should I? I wouldn't be heard anyway. I was strong. I could handle whatever abuse they could dish out. I wouldn't give in. I'd stand there and take it like a good girl. No tears, not one. I knew how to push my wants and needs aside. Was I gullible? Was I easily manipulated? Remember, a narc or NPD is very charming and likable. They are the masters of manipulation. They lie so good they convince themselves they're telling the truth. The first stage of the relationship with the narc is love bombing. It's not abusive. Even for the narc, it feels real. For me, I felt more secure with who I was when I first met him. The things he said and did to me made me like myself more. I felt more confident and deserving of things I told myself I didn't need. I began believing things he told me about myself. He loved how smart I was and how pretty and sexy. He made me feel desirable. He bought me gifts for no reason except to see me smile. I wasn't aware that he suffered from NPD. I didn't even know what narcissist meant. I never knew someone to live a life that's a lie. Was I that gullible, naive? Maybe. Addicted to the love bombing and feelings like I finally found the person that makes me feel loved, who encourages me to be who I am and sees it in me that nobody else has, it's a great feeling. This is why lack of love for myself is clear. This is where I allow myself to be manipulated and abused. I've set no boundaries. I didn't need boundaries for love bombing. This is when the narcissist needs a person like me. All I'm thinking about during this devaluating stage is I love the love bombing. I need it. I suffered through anything to get more of it. This is where I was easily manipulated. So this, he says, this is when the narc is bored. Not even he understands why he's bored, but he's mad at me because he is. He says and does hateful and cruel things. He blames me. Not only do I miss the love bombing, but so does he. My childhood taught me to walk on eggshells. I learned to survive the storm. I was strong. But the wrath of the narc has no empathy. He had let me feel love for myself, a taste of something I never had before. In doing that, I would never be the same. I knew what I had been missing. And she goes on, but I think those are some very strong words that really left me kind of...
Those are. You know, at the beginning, she was talking about if you have healthy self-love, then you won't be vulnerable to a narcissist. And in many ways, that's true. However, there's very few people in this culture that have that kind of self-love when they're young. I think as people get older, they get more and more sense of who they are. And they're more sure of themselves. But I think when we're young, we're much more vulnerable to other people's views and opinions. And we live in a society that is very perfectionistic. And I think there was a study done a number of years ago looking at parenting in different cultures. And the United States was evaluated as the most critical parenting model, that we are always telling our children they could do better and they should get better grades and they should act better, and we're always focused on making them a better person rather than really conveying to our children how much we love them just as they are. So yes, I think young people are very vulnerable to narcissists. And the more trauma and disregard and lack of appreciation that you've felt growing up, the more vulnerable you are. And I definitely think narcissists are very good at picking those people out of the crowd.
That's what I wanted to ask
you. They can zero in. They can zero in on the person who will give in to them, who will suddenly blossom because they gave him a compliment, who will do the things they want within the first few minutes of meeting them.
So, I mean, so you think it's a conscious effort on their part to find someone who can be love-bombed by them into submission to give up everything they have?
I don't think it's conscious in the way a sociopath is conscious of picking someone. I think it's those are the people that they feel the most comfortable with. If you want everything your own way, you're going to feel most comfortable with the people who just naturally love giving it to you. And so there is a magnetic attraction between caretaking people and narcissists. So if you don't want to get into a relationship like this, you need to really look at how healthy is your self-love? Where are you, and what do you need to do to create greater self-love, self-compassion, greater resilience within yourself so you can stand up for yourself?
I'd like to ask your opinion on something a little off topic, but in all your experiences, you know, being a therapist, I know a lot of times when we're younger as women, and especially women who maybe have issues, I'm not even sure what all the issues are, when we're looking to meet someone, you know, they always talk about, well, nice guys come out last because girls are looking for guys who are the bad guys. And I think this is just typical of many people, even seeing the movie Grease again, with Olivia Newton-John go, you know, that, you know, main character, another main character is going after the bad boys. And I think maybe there's something there of us thinking that we can fix them and make them not so bad. Do you ever see this happening in relationships, that nice girls are just going after bad guys?
Well, I think a lot of times they convince themselves that the guy isn't really that bad underneath. And like you say, they start thinking about, well, with just a little of my help and love, he's really going to shine and he'll become the person that I really want him to be. And so it's a delusional fantasy that women have. And it doesn't do them any good because people don't change who they are. If you go into a relationship with the assumption that this other person that you're in love with is going to need to have some major changes, then you're already on a disastrous path. You need to be able to say, I want to be who I am, and I want a partner who, the way they are already, is the perfect person for me. Is the person I would find I could enjoy being around for the next 50 years. And most of the time, we don't have the experience to know even what that would be. What could I put up with for 50 years? So, you know, we actually do leave young people kind of out on their own in a land of movies and songs and delusional ideas about how relationships work. And there's going to be a lot of mistakes. We have a pretty high divorce rate because of that. But I don't know of another solution other than really doing the best you can as a parent to raise your children to be strong and healthy and confident in themselves and to know who they are. And that takes time and energy and attention. And sometimes I worry that parents don't have enough of that time.
Well, today with people working so hard, I mean, I'm guilty of that too. When my children were growing
up,
all
are.
And I look back. Yeah, I look back and I think, you know, why couldn't I have spent more time with them? Maybe their lives would have been better. You know, I sit and feel remorse over that. And so I think that that's one problem. But I also feel that in a lot of cases, dysfunction begets dysfunction. And I see it so much in the women that I work with, starting with number one, me. You you know, when you don't come from a functional home, then you don't really realize what function is. So you're able to latch on to these relationships that aren't functional, and you think, well, that's normal because that's what I grew up in.
Well, exactly. Like the writer that you just quoted, I mean, when she's saying, you know, I didn't feel loved or beautiful, and now someone is telling me I am. The love bombing is, you're really vulnerable to that if you grew up in a dysfunctional home where you didn't get your needs met.
And as she
so
said,
education,
she never
reading books, listening to programs like yours, doing everything you can to shore up and fill up yourself and love yourself so you really feel deserving of someone who will treat you well. And that can take time.
A lot of women feel that it takes a lot of time to really recover from these marriages. And there's so many different issues that we face in these marriages that maybe other marriages don't face the same issues. One of it is gaslighting, I like to call it the gay lighting aspect of the marriage, where your husband's always making you doubt yourself and making you think that what you're seeing is not there, that you must be crazy or you're imagining things. And they often do that to protect themselves, you know, when they're on the verge of getting caught. And this translates into every aspect of life. And I think that this is something that's really hard for women to get past as far as trusting themselves again. Do you have any good suggestions for building trust in yourself?
Well, taking the time to listen to what you're feeling. That can be a challenge because when you've been in a relationship like this for a long time and been told that you're crazy and your perceptions are wrong, and you grew up with parents who said the same thing, it's going to be hard to trust your feelings. In fact, I have gone through life that I didn't even know what my own feeling was because I could feel other people's feelings stronger than I could feel my own. And I remember one day when I finally figured out, I sat for an hour and a half beside this river and I kept bringing my attention back and saying, what am I feeling right this minute? And then my mind would shoot off to, oh, what's he doing? What's going on here? What do my kids feel about this? How would my parents think? And then I would bring myself back. It was exhausting. And I finally did it. And I realized, oh, this is what I feel. And the minute I knew what I felt, I knew exactly what I needed to do. But until I could tune in to what I was feeling, I couldn't figure out a solution or a direction to take. So it takes practice, but it's fairly simple. You just keep coming back. I don't care what anybody else is feeling. If none of these people existed in the world, how am I feeling? And getting in touch with that helps you then figure out who you are and what you need. Takes practice.
This is a process,
and
right? It doesn't happen overnight, correct?
That's right. You know, I've been hearing about my own feelings. I've been saying my own feelings for forever, but I hadn't really felt my own feelings. I hadn't really tuned in that, you know, really, this is what I feel and what I want. And if you aren't following what you feel and what you truly want in your heart, then you're on the wrong path, and nothing is going to work right. You talk about women staying in marriages for years and years, hoping that things will get better. Well, if they were sitting down and tuning in and saying, what do I feel right now, they would know when it was time to leave. So it's a lot of practice. And I think having support people. Go ahead.
I think it's so hard sometimes when you've lived a daily life year in and year out, being put down, made feel inadequate. Women have to really, once again, get the strength to leave. You know, the women who come to me are not looking to stay in their marriages. Well, they do come to me like that, and I send them elsewhere because I don't believe in it. You know, when you're married to a gay man, that's not what I call a marriage. You know, that's what I call a disaster or mismarriage. It was a mistake, you know, where you were young. He was young. He didn't know what he was or didn't understand it. He knew he had those feelings, you know, towards men, but he was hoping he could love a woman and not be gay. And I understand that. I work with hundreds of men every year.
Mm-hmm.
But my point is that, you know, we're the ones who are really left in such bad shape because while they're figuring their life out, you know, they're not concerned about how our life is. And we keep hoping against hope that this nightmare will stop. So, and it doesn't, it just intensifies and gets worse. So there's no good solution in staying together in a marriage that's not working for you, as I tell women. You know, you can't just give yourself to a man to make him happy because he's not going to be happy with you because you're a woman and he's gay. It's like fire and water. It doesn't bind together, right?
And
but
at the same time, it's breaking up is hard to do because you can, when I divorced my narcissistic husband, I lost my house. I had a practice that was in my home, so I lost my office. I lost the people that I was counseling because I was too involved with my own pain and anguish. So I had to start everything over. And I really appreciate the frightening feeling of that, that, okay, if I let go of this, then I have to start everything over. And for women, because financially we are often more dependent on men than they are on us, that there's that factor as well. So it's really hard. It takes a lot of courage. It takes a lot of determination to go ahead and do what is right for you. But I think it's well worth it.
And it's not funny, you know. When you talk about courage, to me it's just so ironic that when gay men who have been in a marriage for 20 or 30 or 40 years, just doing everything, you know, that they can not to have to be honest with their wives, including blaming them for all their mistakes, but they come out and all of a sudden they're the ones with the courage. I think that you just gave me the best idea. We have to be proactive and say, we're the ones with the courage because we're getting out of a marriage to a gay man. I mean, why don't people look
absolutely
at us and applaud what we do with the gay man? Our women seem
to go more into a closet
after their husbands, right? You know, it's like the sense of embarrassment and shame that now that people are looking at them, didn't you know, or was he gay when he married you? You know, that there's so much stigma to this, but I think like with the gay community, they stood up and fought for themselves, and I admire that more than anything because I'm a fighter myself. But our women have to come out, and they also have to say, you know, we had the courage. We should be commended, right?
Absolutely, because you're giving up your entire lifestyle and your life, and you have to start over as much as they do. So, yes, definitely. It is a courageous step, and that's why you need support and group support, therapy support, friends. And I don't see why, you know, women who have narcissistic husbands or gay husbands or any other kind of husband who is not being a husband, that the woman should be embarrassed about that. She has nothing to be embarrassed about his behavior. That is his behavior, not yours. You are trying to be loyal and honest and do everything you could to make things work. And there's no way to make it work. So you're smart and you're courageous to walk away and start a new life. And you deserve to do that.
And I agree with
you
1,000%.
Yes.
Because I feel that I was
very
lucky.
Why should women? Go ahead.
Yeah, why should women? Yeah, I was going to say I felt very lucky because my ex-husband got mad at me, very angry at me, like 5 years into a very horribly abusive marriage, and he walked out thinking he was going to teach me a lesson that after a week I would crumble. And he came back a week later, suitcase in hand, and I said, why are you here? He said, well, I'm coming home.
Good for you.
And I only knew that 1 week it took for me to regain who I once was. And I said to him, no, you're not coming home. You left the house. He said to me, are you willing to break up a family? I said, no, you broke up the family. You're the one who walked out. And he says, well, you know, I came back. I said, no, you came back because you thought that I was going to change and learn my lesson. I said, it's not going to work that way now. I don't want you back. And I was so fortunate that I didn't have to stay every day living in a state of survival and depression. That I had that week, he did me the greatest favor by walking out, because then I didn't have to be the dish rag I had become during that marriage. And I regained my strength, and no matter how hard it was, two little babies, no resources, and back then I only had a GED, I didn't have any college or education beyond that. And yet,
yeah.
I was so much happier in my struggle without, you know, than being with him without that struggle. So, you know, I agree with you. I wouldn't have been able to meet my soulmate, you know, it's almost 25 years we're celebrating, you know, in January, and have the good quality
mm-hmm.
of life that I've had, I would have remained in a destructive marriage. So that's why I always advise
right.
women, every day you live with an abusive situation is the day you have lost that you're never going to get back. And that's what I tell them, right?
Yes.
So believe it or
and,
not, we're
and
coming to the
you
end
should
of
look
our show.
At- I was just going to say
sorry,
you should look at the end of a relationship like this as your opportunity to get exactly what you want in life.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, and not to have to suffer for one more day. But I want to let people know that they can go to your website, which I'm now on, because it's also on our, you know, Blog Talk Radio there. And
good.
If you go to Dr. Phil,
yes.
You know, her website, it's MargalisTherapy.com, and anybody can go to it. I have it on, once again, if you're listening to this broadcast, and it will be in our newsletter coming up. You know, you have Dr. Margalis's, Dr. Felstead's blogs, which are wonderful. The services, because she can do consulting with you over any kind of destructive relationship by phone. You don't have to be where she is. And she has a lot of wonderful information there. I get her free newsletter every month, and I post it for our group, but, you know, I send it out also to other people, and they're just so impressed by the words that you have to say. And I can't thank you enough for being part of our network, because women are always learning and their lives are always improving because of you. And that says a lot, because it takes a lot of commitment from somebody that you volunteer your time to be on this show. And I am extremely grateful that you do that, because it does change people's lives. You are definitely a life changer. So I want to thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Bonnie. And I want to say the same. You are definitely a lifesaver. And thank you so much for all that you do.
Yes. So we're looking forward to having you back in the spring. I'll keep bothering you.
I'd love to come back.
All right. And to all of our listeners, we wish you a very happy Thanksgiving holiday. And I'll be sending out some little snippets from Dr. Felstead's columns on holidays and getting through them on our next newsletter. And I wish all of you a wonderful holiday. Dr. Felstead, I hope you have the best Thanksgiving. And if I have to think of something I'm grateful for, it's you. I am very grateful for
Hello.
You.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
All right. So love to all of you, and love to you, Dr. Felstead. I hope you have a marvelous holiday, and I'll talk to you again soon.
Well, happy Thanksgiving to you as well.
Thank you so much. To all our listeners, good night and have a wonderful week. Bye-bye.